Welcome everybody, welcome to Cedar Ridge. My name is Matthew, I'm the lead pastor here, so I'm going to be talking for the next few minutes. And we are today in part two of a series on the book of Revelation. So we kind of took the bold step this summer of diving into the last book of the Bible, one of the more controversial books of the Bible, perhaps one of the least understood. And we're going to kind of hold our breath and hope that we come out at the end of it with a little more understanding, at least. And not that we're necessarily going to understand it fully, but perhaps with a little more understanding. So this week's part two. Remember, last week we talked introduction. You know, it was a little bit of context, gave some historical background to the book. You know, in the first century CE or AD in which it's set. We're going to find out today that actually the whole book really is a message sent to seven churches that were in the western part of present-day Turkey. And so, you know, that's the context for the letter. And so it's important that we recognize that context so we don't kind of just think that it was sent to us in the 21st century. We're going to rather look at those messages to these seven churches today and work out what did this all mean to them, and then make some applications to our own lives. We've got to bear that in mind, the historical context. But you may remember last week, one of the things we talked about was the fact that there's been a lot of sensationalism around the book of Revelation, particularly, you know, in perhaps the last century. And we kind of had a little chuckle at some of the ways in which people have used it to perhaps make predictions about the end of the world and that kind of thing. And very often those predictions have not come right. But we also said, at least those people are reading it. At least they're reading the book. And, you know, if you're anything like me, I try to kind of skirt around Revelation because it's a tricky book to read. It's confusing. It can feel very judgmental. It's very sort of black and white. It's very good and evil, but it separates those things out very clearly. And, you know, sometimes that can be difficult for us, especially when we feel like we live in a world where there's a lot of gray. But rather than avoiding it, we're going to look it square in the eye and try and work out what does it mean and how can we apply it to ourselves in this situation. Now, I think it's also something that our culture have got to do. It's not just religious people. There's a couple of movies out at the moment. I don't know if you've seen any of these movies about the end of the world. You know, movies about the end of the world are very popular. We talked about zombie apocalypses last week a little bit. Do we have any of those slides? Okay, so anybody seen this movie?
Not yet.
Not yet, because it's only come out in England. Okay, that's an English movie, so it's bound to be good. And that comes out, I think, in a few weeks' time. That'll be on the sort of more light-hearted side. This one, however, will be dead serious. Maybe we'll look at the next one. Which is, anybody seen this movie? Is there only one person seen that movie? Wow. I haven't seen it yet, but not vouching for the movie in any sense there at all. But our series is called This Is Not the End, which is not a play on that movie, which is called This Is the End. But, you know, both sort of apocalyptic, humorous apocalyptic type movies. But, you know, it's there in our culture. You know, we talk about the end of the world. I mean, people talk about it. We're fascinated by it. Sir Isaac Newton, that great scientist, wrote a book on Revelation. I think we have a little picture of Sir Isaac. Do we have a picture of Sir Isaac? Yes, there he is. Sir Isaac Newton looks a little bit like a 1970s rock guitarist. Anyway, he was a great scientist. He actually thought, you know, just as he had applied rules to the laws of nature, you know, he saw uniformity in nature and sort of picked that out and described, I mean, some incredible scientific notions. He took the same approach to the book of Revelation, thinking like, maybe we can pick this apart and work out what it means and interpret it that way. And he wrote a book on it. Has anybody read Sir Isaac Newton's book on Revelation? Neither have I. But it's apparently quite a read, and he draws some very outlandish conclusions which we have since found out were not accurate. So it's kind of defeated even the best of us, I guess you could say, in that respect. But I think we're always constantly trying to apply it. Here's my favorite book, sort of apocalyptic type book. Maybe you can put the next one up. Okay, how to tell if your boyfriend is the Antichrist. And then I like the little subtitle there. And if he is, should you break up with him? Really, is that a question I'm feeling? Well, anyway, that's Jimmy's book. It's, I think, a little tongue-in-cheek about relationships. Has anybody read that book? Oh, we're just a illiterate group of people. So it's a bestseller view for sure. Anyway, so you know, we're going to be wrestling in the way that other people are wrestling with it, trying to apply these things to our own lives. Maybe we'll find out we are going out with the Antichrist or something like that. Who knows? But we're going to take it seriously. Dig deep. We do discussion questions with this each week. I apologize, last week the discussion questions went up pretty late. Sorry about that, but they are up already for this week. So if you want to dig a little deeper into it on your own or in a group, you know, group of friends or in your discipleship groups, the discussion questions can be downloaded online. And in this week's discussion questions, there's some additional resources. So you know, we've got four more weeks to deal with the book of Revelation. We're not going to deal with everything. There's loads of things that I'm going to be missing out and not even addressing. So just impossible to cover it all in the space that we have. So check out the discussion questions this week, because there's some other resources there. If you want to continue to study the book, dig a little deeper, there's some resources that I've pointed you to there. There are many others as well. So what I would do is maybe take some of those resources, go on somewhere like Amazon and look at what other links there are to other books and other bits of information that can add to the experience. Okay, so do check those out. And there's some other things in the discussion questions this week as well, so do download those. Now, looking back a little bit to last week, we touched on some really important issues, I think, and I just want to bring one of those to the fore this week again, because it's relevant to what we're going to be talking about in terms of chapters 2 and 3, which is the focus for this week, and the messages to the seven churches that this vision has been sent to, this vision of John. The issue I want to talk about is that John gives us this glimpse into the unseen world. Okay, so if we just read Revelation through, and I'd really encourage you to read it, try and read it in one sitting, or maybe a couple of sittings. It's challenging in terms of content, but it's not really, really long. So you could get through it with just a sit down and a decent read. But as you read it, it's bizarre, it's all this fantastic imagery, that can actually make it very, very tricky for us. But if we bear in mind the fact that John is writing in the tradition of a prophet, he says that right at the beginning. And in the tradition of the prophets, the great Hebrew prophets, as we talked about last week, they saw life in very intense multicolor. They saw life not as separated between physical and spiritual. They saw life all together. Okay, we, in our 21st century mindset, tend to be very comfortable with the physical, things we can see, hear, touch, smell, etc. Things we can investigate. And that's probably been true since the Enlightenment, you know, since the scientific revolution of the 18th century, and you know, we have a much deeper and better understanding of the universe now. And that's a wonderful thing. That's a really good thing, I think. The trouble is, I think we've tended to put our trust and our faith and our confidence in things that we understand, things that we can explain. And increasingly, as we began to explain things, we felt that we know everything that there is to know. So we understand things like gravity and electromagnetism and all that kind of stuff. So those aren't spooky concepts to us anymore. But more recently, I think we've also come around to realize that there's still loads of things we don't understand, and there's loads of phenomena that we don't understand. And maybe there's more to life than meets the eye. And that's what John is really doing for us. John is saying to these churches, he's saying, look, you're in all sorts of different situations, and we're going to get into what those situations are. All sorts of challenging situations. But let me tell you this, there's more to this than meets the eye. John writes in the tradition of the prophets who saw evil really intensely. They didn't see a kind of evil as a grey thing. They saw it as desperately bad. And they would challenge people about the way they were living, challenge institutions about the way they were operating, challenge governments about how they were governing. They wouldn't pull their punches at all. But they also talked about something very good. They talked about a future hope. They said, look, life doesn't have to be like this. Life could be this beautiful thing. And they talked about incredible beauty in the future, of people being reconciled to one another, of there being peace, of people beating their swords into plowshares, of the lion lying with the lamb, some kind of even cosmic reconciliation that would take place. They talked about that future beauty. So they talked very intensely about evil, but they had great hope for the future. And they primarily spoke, this is a little bit of a recap, they primarily spoke to people who were relatively comfortable. These Hebrew prophets were writing in the 8th century BCE up until about the 5th century BCE, when life wasn't too bad for the people of Israel and Judah. They had power, they had comforts, they had wealth, a lot of them. And so the messages were often challenging to people in their state of comfort about how their comforts were being abused, or how actually their comforts had led them astray even, and they were becoming selfish and self-centered and abusive of other people. And there was particular challenges for the powerful, particular challenges for institutions that had power. But then after that, the people of Israel went into exile. They were defeated by empires, and those empires themselves got defeated by other empires, and other empires came afterwards. You know, the whole cycle of empire kept happening. When we read in the book of Revelation, we're in the context of yet another empire, the Roman Empire. Empires come and go. Everybody has their day, it seems. But, you know, as Jesus said, you know, if you live by the sword, you die by the sword. It's as though empires eventually self-destruct. But they were taken off into exile. They were persecuted. Many of them returned eventually, but they went through great persecution up until the time of Jesus. And in that era, a different kind of prophetic writing evolved, which was called apocalyptic literature. And we have some examples of that in the Bible, but it's mainly in Jewish writings that aren't in our Old Testament or have not gone into our New Testament in any sense. And those writings talk about, there's kind of a new phenomenon in those writings. It's similar to the prophetic writing, but it's very graphic, much more imagery, like what we see in Revelation. But also there's this sense of humanity is caught up in this battle between good and evil. There's the forces of good on the side of God, and there's the forces of evil on the side of the devil. And those forces are fighting out this cosmic battle that we can't see, but we are subject to it. And that's somewhat different to the prophets, because the prophets would say, be good. They would say, that's a human choice, you know, like, stop being abusive, stop being selfish, love other people, care for the poor. They would talk about it in very human terms, whereas the apocalypticist talks about it in more cosmic terms. They said, for sure, be good, and we see that very often in the book of Revelation, for instance, where there's a lot of emphasis placed on deeds. People will be evaluated based on what they've done. Not on what they thought, or what they thought they thought, or not on what they even believed necessarily, but how they lived their lives. That's a strong emphasis in the book of Revelation. So that's certainly there, but there's this sense in apocalyptic literature that we're caught up in this cosmic battle, we're caught up in between the forces of good and evil. And we're not 100% subject to them, but that's a big factor in our lives. So there's something else being played out. And John is writing in the style of an apocalypticist. He's saying, look, there's more to life than meets the eye. There are forces of good and there are forces of evil at work. Be aware of these things. Maybe your situation, the situation that you're in, will make more sense if you're aware of what's already going on. Now, I think we have a challenge there because, as I was saying, we don't really think like that. But maybe the challenge isn't so great. I mean, what I mean is we don't think in terms of forces of good and evil, you know, sort of being acted out cosmically around us. But maybe we're not so far away from it. Firstly, let's think about this. The people that John is writing to, the people that we're going to be kind of partnering up with throughout this series, they're people in the first century AD, but they wouldn't take what John is saying literally. Okay, they realize this is literature. This is, John is painting a picture to bring certain truths into focus. Like, I don't think the people are thinking, oh, my big problem then is there's a great big red dragon with 7 heads and 10 horns. That's the problem. Their problem was Rome. Their problem was people oppressing them, persecuting them. That's one of the problems. You know, there's several issues going on. But John is painting this out and describing it in vivid terms to help people understand that there's something deeper happening, something broader happening, something more cosmic happening. But they're not necessarily interpreting his word pictures literally, just as we're not interpreting them literally. At the same time, I think we can relate in perhaps a similar way to those first century people to unseen forces. Like, we know, we've all experienced, I think, being in a room where we get a bad sense of something. I hope you're not getting that right now. But you know, a kind of a vibe, a feel. We might get that from a person. Like, I don't know whether you've ever had a conversation with a person where you came away just feeling totally drained in a way that you can't explain it just emotionally and psychologically. I mean, that may contribute to it somewhat, but there's some other force going on. And I'm not saying that therefore that person is evil. I'm just saying there are unseen forces at work that we don't necessarily fully understand. And I think sometimes it seems like they're cumulative, you know, like people together can create forces that no one individual ever intended to create. For instance, we have forces at work in our culture that can culminate in such hatred that it results in genocide, the genocide of millions of people. Something that perhaps no one person would have ever dreamt they could be capable of, or that could possibly happen. We all know that we have hatred in our hearts. We all have prejudice. We harbor that evil, if you like. We all brush with that every day. But can it have a cumulative force that takes on the life of its own? And can that force exert influence around the world? Well, I think it can if we think about racism, sexism, all kinds of hatred and prejudice that's perpetrated. It's insidious. We may not really be able to touch it or feel it or taste it, but it's real and it's present and it has a profound impact on our lives, profound impact on how we think, how we operate, what we do, what we don't do. So I think to some degree we can relate to the fact that we're caught up. There are all kinds of forces at work influencing us. We, for instance, may not be anywhere near as free as we really think. We may be enslaved to all kinds of things, like money, comfort, security, while actually we walk around thinking we're really free because, you know, we're not in prison, those things don't seem to have a great hold on us. And John's message to these early churches is just that. It's just, wake up, see the reality. And he says it in stark terms. He says it in shocking terms. He uses this imagery which is almost overwhelming. I describe it as kind of like exponential imagery. I don't know whether that's I don't think that's a literary term in any sense. I just made it up. But what I mean by that is, for instance, next week we're going to look at some of the passages that talk about this this sort of apocalyptic battle. And there's seven seals and around the scroll. And as each one is opened, it unleashes calamity after calamity, let's say, including the four horsemen of the apocalypse. Some of my personal favorites from Revelation. So it unleashes all these terrible things. And then the seventh seal is opened, and you think, like, oh gosh, we got to the end, it's the seventh seal. But then the seventh seal opens, reveals seven trumpets. And those seven trumpets, each, as they blast, they each release another calamity, which eventually culminates in the great dragon, and then the great dragon ushers in the beast, and then there's another beast, and it's kind of like, it's almost like, you know, it feels like cheating. It's like, you know, the genie that gives you three wishes, and your final wish is, I want three more wishes. It's one of those kind of things where it just seems to go on and on, and it's graphic, and it builds, and it's huge, but it always cycles back round to hope. It always brings everybody back to a hopeful future, what can be done, what the future can be like. So we go through these cycles of calamity and hope, cycles of battle with evil and a hopeful future. And I think the cycles, as we go through them, you know, we're going to see, again, more about this next week, we'll see the world come to an end several times. So it's clearly not a linear progression. And I think that's one of the reasons why we should be very careful about using Revelation to make historical predictions or predictions about history or the history that we're in, because it's just not written that way. It's all these cycles of things that are happening, each cycle driving us towards hope and driving us to a deeper understanding of what's really going on in the universe. Now, let's turn then to these churches. Maybe we can just put up the first map. So there's a little bit of, I think, important context to the way in which these churches were this message. So again, we're in chapters 2 and 3 of Revelation. Now here's a little bit of the Eastern Mediterranean, which may be familiar to some of you. We have, actually I've got a little pointer here, which I'm going to use. I love these things. There we go. So that's sort of present-day Greece. There's Western Turkey, which is where all these churches are. There's the Aegean Sea. So this is all Eastern Mediterranean. We don't actually see Patmos on there, but Patmos is round about here, a tiny little speck round about here. Very small island. That's the island that John was on, from which he's writing. I talked about that a little bit later. So you can see that he's pretty close to where these churches are. Let's zoom in on the churches. And the color of this next slide, you might need sunglasses for it. Just, maybe we can do the next slide. Okay, sorry, it's not a great slide. It looked way better on my laptop than it looked there. But you can see we've got these seven churches. We've got Ephesus, Smyrna, and Pergamum on the coast. And then we have Thyatira, Sardis, Philadelphia, and Laodicea a little further inland. The coastal cities were much bigger, more cosmopolitan, as you would expect. There were ports. And the ones further inland, a little more provincial. You can see Patmos again, the tiny little island that John's writing for. He was an exile there, it seems, because he had this message that the Romans wanted to suppress. They didn't want him propagating this kind of message out there, but he somehow got this message out to these seven churches. So let's just look at the list of the seven churches that were... So that's where they are. Here's the seven churches that we're dealing with. Ephesus, Smyrna, Pergamum, Thyatira, Sardis, Philadelphia, Laodicea. What we have in chapters 2 to 3 is a message to each of those churches. And the messages follow a pretty similar format. Again, I really recommend reading them. We're not going to go through each one today. We're going to jump in one at the beginning, one at the end, and one in the middle. But they have there's some similarities to them. The way they're written, the sort of format of them. Also, each one kind of gets three messages in one. And the three parts of those messages are encouragement. So John says, hey, look, Jesus speaking through John, should we say, because the message, John makes it really clear, this is a message from Jesus. So Jesus says, look, I like what you're doing. There's some good things here, so some encouragement, but there's also some criticism. There's a sort of a big but coming, and you can almost tell that, you know, it starts off, hey, I like this, I like that, but, and then there's this bit's not so good. And then there's encouragement, there's criticism, and then there's a challenge. There's a kind of like, here's what you can do. And each of them get that, with a few exceptions. Actually, Smyrna and Philadelphia don't get any criticism. So pretty nifty. Laodicea, on the other hand, doesn't get any encouragement. I mean, it's all bad for Laodicea. We're going to look at Laodicea at the end. But these churches would be receiving these messages as very personal to them, no doubt. But also there's some sort of general application to all of them as well. Now, this gets to an issue of interpretation, and what I've done in the discussion questions this week is give some resources, as I mentioned, some of which compare different views about how to interpret Revelation. So there's a couple of books there that say four different views on, you know, the apocalypse, or four different views on Revelation. For instance, over these chapters, some people interpret these chapters as saying the seven churches weren't messages to seven specific churches. The seven churches represent seven stages in development of personal spirituality. Maybe. Some people say, the seven churches represent seven stages in the development of the church through history, so they have a more sort of future orientation to it. Maybe. But all I think we can say is, this is a message that John says is going to seven churches in cities that we know existed and we have historical records of. And so it would behoove us really to think, how did they apply to them? And then how can we apply it to ourselves? All right, so we're just going to take that approach, pretty practical kind of approach. Now, let's jump in on Ephesus. Okay, so if we look at chapter 2, the beginning of chapter 2, let's just look at the language. To the angel of the church at Ephesus write, and I'm not even going to talk about the fact that it's writing to an angel. Okay, that's one of the things I'm going to miss out, because we'll be there all day. Very interesting to think about, but we're not going to go there. These are the words of him who holds the seven stars in his right hand and walks among the seven golden lampstands. Okay, so we've already found out in chapter 1 that the golden lampstands represent the churches. So there's this sense, I think, of the churches needing to be bright, shining lights. You know, Jesus said in the Sermon on the Mount, don't hide your light under a bushel. You know, your light should be like a city on a hill. In other words, our lives should shine forth. There's a sense, I think, that the challenge is that these churches would burn bright. Okay, I know your deeds, your hard work, and your perseverance. I know that you cannot tolerate wicked men, that you have tested those who claim to be apostles but are not, and you have found them false. You have persevered, and you have endured hardships for my name, and have not grown weary. Yet I hold this against you. Here it comes. You have forsaken your first love. Remember the height from which you have fallen. Repent and do the things you did at first. If you do not repent, I will come to you and remove your lampstand from its place. But you have this in your favor. You hate the practice of the Nicolaitans, which I also hate. It's not the Nickelodeons. We have a little service for the children and youth leaders before this service, and someone was reading that and referenced the Nickelodeon. So God's okay. I think God's okay with the Nickelodeons. Pretty much. He who has an ear, let him hear what the Spirit says to the churches. To him who overcomes, I will give the right to eat from the tree of life, which is in the paradise of God. Okay, that is packed with all kinds of stuff. We're going to pick out a couple of things. Firstly, what's encouraging there? What is the church being encouraged about at Ephesus? What was the thumbs up about? Anybody?
Purity.
Yeah, purity. So they don't suffer fools gladly. Kind of thing. They're testing things. I mean, we're talking about the early stages of the church. The church is spreading over a huge area. A lot of people were saying they were in the way of following the way of Jesus, but weren't really, and they were trying to teach other things. And they kind of discern that, and they've weeded that out. Yeah, so there's a sense of, they're pretty astute. Yeah. Anything else? Perseverance. Persistence and perseverance. Yeah, so what's the implication there? It actually uses the term hardship, right? It says they persevered in the context of hardship. What's the implication? What's happening to them, probably? Persecution, right? Suffering. So, this is a theme through many of these messages, that it's persevere, either commending them for persevering, and in the next letter, actually, the letter to Smyrna, there's a sense of somebody actually already having been martyred. So there's a person mentioned by name. So there's this persevere, even though you're being persecuted, through hardship, and they're congratulated because they're remaining true to the faith. What's the challenge? What are they, or what are they criticized about? What is the but? They've lost their first love. Okay, so their issue is love. So and think about this for a moment. Like, here's a church being persecuted, where they're having to discern between, okay, what is right and wrong? What is in the way of Jesus and what isn't? Like, you can debate theology all day in a moment of peace and think, maybe that, maybe this. If you're being persecuted, what are you prepared to die for? Right? What are you prepared to endure through? What really matters? So you can imagine that these guys are having to work things out and work out what they really believe, what they really stand for in that context. But somehow in that context, they've kind of lost their love. It's become analytical. It's become rote. It's become, perhaps their hearts have become hardened. And you can understand why. And I think we've all experienced that. You know, when maybe we see that in other people, maybe we see it in ourselves, where people can be critical or analytical, sometimes some love can be lost, right? And the spirit of the thing can be lost. And that seems to be what Jesus is challenging them about. And there's this call to return to their first love. And I sort of come back to that image of the candlestick. It's almost like Jesus is saying, stir up the fire again. I mean, isn't that something that we can all relate to? And this is more than just to Ephesus. This theme recurs. There's this return to me. Return to your first love. Return to that first passion. And this really is a challenge about commitment and passion to Jesus, commitment and passion to this cause. I mean, is there one of us in this room who doesn't need to be stirred up again, who doesn't need to have some of that passion that perhaps we once had, that we once felt? Do we not need that stirring up again? Do we not need that fire lighting again? Do we not need that candlestick to burn brighter? That seems to be the challenge to Ephesus, but by extension, perhaps to us. Now, let's jump ahead and just look at we're going to pick the next church is the church at Pergamum. But what I'm going to do is just kind of summarize, because we're not going to go through all three. I'm just going to summarize what I think are three main themes that are spoken to these churches. Okay, and you can read them and you may see some other themes there. I'm just kind of saying how I read it. The first theme is definitely suffering. Okay, many of these churches are suffering. That suffering, as we talked about last week, was imposed partly by the Roman state. I think we have a couple of pictures of Nero, who probably predated this letter, and Domitian, his successor, who we know from historical records had declared himself God and wanted to be worshipped as God, which was even Romans thought that was arrogant and ridiculous. So we're talking about that era where the state required you to require absolute loyalty, even deifying the emperor. And if you refused to do that, you were in big trouble. At the same time, I think it's not accurate for us to assume that all persecution came from the top down from the state, where the empire would come in and round people up and ship them off and put them in prison or throw them to the lions. That certainly happened, it seems. But there's a more subtle form of persecution that took place. And that was kind of like peer-level persecution, or persecution from the ground up. And it works like this. If you are living in Ephesus, or if you're living in Smyrna, if you're living in some of the outlying areas of the Roman Empire, you want to show that you're loyal. You know, as a culture, as a community, you want to show loyalty to the empire, because disloyalty to the empire results in one simple thing, and that is the soldiers coming in. It results in repression, it results in oppression. So you would be keen to show loyalty to the emperor. So if you've got people in your community that are being disloyal, you would want to sort of self-management of the community. You want to keep those people quiet. And persecution would often come at that level. Coupled with that is a more religious sense of persecution, which is in that pagan era with the Greco-Roman gods, it was normal to worship lots of gods and keep all the gods happy. And if you kept the gods happy, then life went okay. You know, the rains would come at the right time, and all the life would go well. That was the deal. So you don't want some person over here saying, oh, there's only one God and we're only going to worship that God, and sort of messing up your interaction with the deities. And so Christians were often blamed for bad luck, for calamities of all kinds, and were persecuted as a result of that. So a little bit like, I think we can probably identify with some of this. It's kind of flipped around, though. You think about, and forgive me for making this statement, but you think about the whole God hates fags movement, if you can call it a movement, of Westboro Baptist Church. The theory there is, oh, there's somebody in our community over here doing something, and therefore we are getting bad luck or judgment or whatever from God, because they're messing it up for all of us. Right? I think we experience some of that to a degree. That perhaps, you know, gay people today experience that kind of level of persecution that the Christians were. Now, you know, it's not on the same scale, but it's the same kind of way in which persecution can work. Or think of various commentators that said Hurricane Katrina was caused by certain groups of people. Right? So it's very easy to point finger and say they're messing life up for the rest of us. In fact, the Pharisees did this to some degree, and it wasn't just the Romans that persecuted Christians. There was persecution from other religions, like the Jewish religion, which was based on the Pharisaical belief that absolute purity is what brings God's blessing. That's why the Pharisees went around all the time worried about who was obeying the law and who wasn't. Because as we become pure before God, as we do the right things perfectly, God loves us and blesses us and life will be great. So if you've got people not doing that, like all these Christians who weren't following the legal code, that's messing it up for everybody else. And that was another source of persecution. Plus, add into the fact that for the Jewish people, they were really worried that Christians were viewed as Jews. Because they were in the early days. Christianity was a Jewish, you know, an offshoot of Judaism. It was a Jewish sect, a movement within Judaism. So they didn't want Judaism to be associated with the rebellion of the Christians, because that would have repercussions from the Romans too. So I think you can see that persecution was not just the power of the state, and we were talking about powers earlier, but it was also power that operates at a very individual level and sort of in at a collective or even an informal collective level as well. That's how this worked. Now, we may find that level of suffering hard to relate to. But some people around the world are suffering that kind of persecution because of their beliefs, and certainly for some people because of their Christian beliefs. In certain countries around the world today, it is very, very difficult to be a follower of Jesus. And we read about some of the, situation in Egypt, for instance, a recurrent situation where the Coptic Christians are being oppressed. But there's other places around the world that, are just as well known. And in the material this week, or the discussion questions this week, there's some websites that you can look at if you would like to pursue that a little further. And read more about persecution in general, but also specifically there's a couple of websites about persecution of Christians around the world, people persecuted for their faith. Perhaps one of the things we can take away from this message to Ephesus and to the other churches is to see that persecution or suffering, let's say suffering, does not mean you're a failure. Suffering does not mean God is far from you. Suffering does not mean that you've done something wrong. Suffering may be because you're close to God. Suffering may be because you're doing the right thing. Now we can get that mixed up, I think. But perhaps the challenge to us is to stand in solidarity with those who are persecuted, those who are oppressed. People of all kinds, and perhaps especially people who are following the way of Jesus in places where it's really, really hard to do that. And so those websites may help us just investigate that a little bit. Now so that's the theme of persecution. I said there's three themes. Here's another theme, the theme of compromise. Let's look at the church from Pergamum. This is the next passage. To the angel of the church of Pergamum, right? These are the words of him who has the sharp, double-edged sword. I know where you live, where Satan has his throne. Okay, so that's pretty stark language, right? I know where you live. I know where you're living, and Satan has his throne there. It's like, oh my gosh, they're being encouraged to see in a different kind of way. Yet you remain true to my name. There's the encouragement. You did not renounce your faith in me, even the days of Antipas, my faithful witness, who was put to death in your city, where Satan lives. So there's another martyr right there. There's a buck coming. Nevertheless, I have a few things against you. You have people who hold to the teaching of Balaam. He's a character in the Hebrew scriptures. You can look him up later. Who taught Balak to entice the Israelites to sin by eating food sacrificed to idols and by committing sexual immorality. Likewise, you also have those who hold to the teachings of the Nicolaitans. By the way, we don't really know who the Nicolaitans were or the Nicolaitans. There was some kind of heretical group, presumably, all sorts of theories about what they did and what they were about, but we just know that they weren't viewed as very positively. Repent, therefore, otherwise I will soon come to you and will fight against them with the sword of my mouth. He who is near to hear, let him hear what the Spirit says to the churches. Okay, I'm just going to home in here in the interest of time on that issue of eating food sacrificed to idols. Okay, there was the sense here, I think, is of compromise. What eating food sacrificed to idols relates to is in that culture, in that pagan culture, in that pagan polytheistic culture, multiple gods, you would go to the temple of various gods, go to the temple of Athena or the temple of Artemis or wherever, and you would make sacrifices, or people who had faith in those gods would make sacrifices. But very often there were public holidays and festivals that everybody was invited to. And the food that was sacrificed would then be eaten as kind of part of a celebration, part of a party. I think what the writer's getting at here is that there seem to be some people who are kind of compromising on their way. They're like, they're blending in with the culture. They're blending in order to perhaps make things socially more acceptable. Maybe there's some, professional advancement. I mean, maybe some of these things are almost like, and it seems like they were used that way, they're almost like business lunches, where it's like, if you're invited to come along, oh sure, I'll come along and participate because there may be some good deals to be made, et cetera, et cetera. So it's as though these people have other idols. It's as though God isn't central. There's other things that are enticing them, and they're making compromises. Maybe we can ask ourselves the same question. What compromises are we making? What governs our decisions? What governs our choices? What governs our practices? I mean, How big do things like career and money and security and those kind of things factor in our lives, and how much do those govern our choices? How much do those govern our decisions? A similar kind of issue, so that's persecution and compromise, a similar kind of issue is the issue that is addressed to the Church of Laodicea. So let's look at that. This is the last church of the seven. Here's what... Go on to the next one. To the angel of the church in Laodicea, write, these are the words of the Amen, the faithful and true witness, the ruler of God's creation. I know your deeds, that you are neither hot nor cold. Sorry, neither cold nor hot. I wish you were either one or the other. So, because you are lukewarm, neither hot nor cold, I am about to spit you out of my mouth. You say, I am rich, I have acquired wealth and do not need a thing. But you do not realize that you are wretched, pitiful, poor, blind, and naked. I counsel you to buy gold from me, gold refined in the fire, so you can become rich, and white clothes to wear, so you can cover your shameful nakedness, and salve to put on your eyes, so you can see. So that's a call to see again. Those whom I love, I rebuke and discipline. So be earnest and repent. Here I am, I stand at the door and knock. If anyone hears my voice and opens the door, I will come in and eat with him, and he with me. To him who overcomes, I will give the right to sit with me on my throne, just as I overcame and sat down with my Father on his throne. He who has an ear, let him hear what the Spirit says to the churches. And that's the ending. And I think that's the ending of hope, I think. It's saying, look, I'm here, I'm standing at the door, it's not all lost. Return to me. There's this invitation right there. But the challenge to the church of Laodicea is what? What's the challenge that's put to them? Or the criticism, let's say. What's the criticism that's put to them? Lukewarm. Okay, lukewarm, neither hot nor cold. Let's call it mediocrity. Apathy, perhaps. And what's the cause of that mediocrity? What's the cause of that lukewarmness?
Losing your first love.
Wealth. Okay, specifically said wealth. It's as there are parts of the empire. Let's think about this in the Roman context. There are parts of the Roman Empire that benefit from that power. Right? Empires bring the promise of peace. Every empire says, oh, we're going to be good for you. You know, we're going to bring peace and coordinate things and make life way better. It's just that if you disagree, or if you're on the wrong side, you're in big trouble. So for some people, as we've seen, the Roman Empire was really bad news, terrible news. But for some people, that Pax Romana, that Roman peace, and the ability to then have communication and trade and etc., resulted in great wealth. And it seems like the people of Laodicea are benefiting from that. So for them, it's like, what's the problem? They don't see any problem. Life's pretty good. And it's resulted in them kind of just being lulled into a false sense of security, like everything's great. I mean, there's other people in other parts of Western Turkey, or in Asia Minor, as it's called there, who really know that it is not okay. But for them, everything seems okay. Now, I would imagine that this is probably the biggest challenge for those of us in this room right now. Because relatively, we are so comfortable, so wealthy, so... rich. So we may not feel there's a problem, but that's part of the problem, right? I mean, that's what John's getting at here, is that we've just been lulled into this false insecurity. Now, again, doesn't mean, I'm not saying therefore there absolutely is a problem, but we are prone to this problem, perhaps more than any other one, perhaps, because of the nature of the life we experience. We experience certain benefits in this part of the world that other people just do not have. We, even in this part of the country, we're experiencing benefits that people in other parts of the country do not have. We have great comfort. And is there a chance that that comfort is giving us our security? Is there a chance that money and security like that is giving us our security? And we're not seeing the bigger picture, which is the fact that all that could just go. And we're going to see in the next few chapters next week how precarious the empire is, how precarious financial security is, how precarious peace is, how precarious all these things that seem to bring security and happiness. The cosmic conflict that's described by John kind of blows those things to pieces. And people
see starkly what really is, and that those things they've been perhaps putting their trust in and relying on are not what they seem, are really not what they seem. What is the challenge for us? Now we're going to sing a song together, prayerfully, and maybe the band, if you guys could just come up, because I'm going to skip a section here. I was going to read chapter 4 to you, but we're pretty much out of time. So we're going to kind of dip in for a moment to some of what we'll be talking about next week. But in chapter 4, there's a scene described. And it's a very strange scene. John is caught up into heaven. And he says, you know, he hears a voice, he looks up, and then he sees the throne of God. Okay, so this is all what he's seeing. It's picture language and imagery. And he sees this throne, and it's obviously God's throne, because it's the thunder and lightning, and he describes what it looks like. It's like the center of the universe. And around that throne are four creatures. One looks like an ox, one looks like an eagle, one looks like a human, one looks like a lion. They're very similar to the creatures that are described by Ezekiel in the first chapter of that prophet's book. And they kind of represent creation, if you like. And creation is not the center of the universe, but around God's throne. And then around that are the 24 elders, you know, representing perhaps human leadership, human stewardship, human power to some degree. And they've all got crowns on their head. And crowns represented power. And, you know, people reading that would have known that Roman emperors had crowns. And people would give crowns to Roman emperors when they defeated their enemies. And but the elders who are wearing the crowns, they take their crowns off and they lay them down. And they say, worthy is the one on the throne. In other words, they say, this is the center of the universe. This is the center of all power. And it seems that perhaps what John is doing is saying to the churches, look, you've got to realign yourselves. You're not aligned as though God is the center of the universe. You're aligned as though money is, or the power of empire is, or getting along with everybody is. And maybe you even feel like, the empire is overcoming. The empire is defeating me. I'm lost. It's all over. But actually, there's something else going on. And that, you know, you need to see that it's not over yet. God is at the center of the universe. So there's this call to realign ourselves. And I think that's a challenge for us, to look at our lives in a different kind of way. To look at our lives as though there is more to life than meets the eye. Can we realign our lives as though God is at the center of the universe? Now in chapter 5, there's a scroll that appears with seven seals, and nobody can open the seals. And there's sort of a bemoaning for the fact that who's worthy to open the seals? And then one of the elders says, there is one who's worthy to open the seals. There is one who has power and authority to open the seals. And we'll talk about this more in more detail next week, but they describe the Lion of Judah and the root of David. And those images conjure up power and warriorship. You know, you think of the Lion of Judah was a symbol for the power of Judah. The root of David was, you know, reference to David, the warrior king, the golden age of power for Israel. But then when John sees the Lion of Judah and sees the root of David, he doesn't see a lion, he doesn't see a warrior. He sees a sacrificed lamb. He sees the Lamb of God. He sees the lamb that was slain. In other words, at the center of the universe is a power that is a totally different power to the kind of power that these churches were experiencing, for good or for bad. There's a power that's totally different to the kind of power that we might be aligned with. This is the true worthy power of the universe is self-sacrifice and love. That's the power of the universe. When all the elders bow down and say, worthy is the Lamb, they're saying, that's true power, that's real power, that's good power. So we're going to come now to the Lamb. We're going to sing a song. It's a song I think probably we know fairly well. It's called Open the Eyes of My Heart, Lord. And the band are going to play it, and I encourage you just to sing it. We're going to stay seated, or you could just listen. But close your eyes, because we're going to try and see with different eyes this morning. We're going to ask God to open the eyes of our heart. We want to see our lives in the context of the kind of vision that John has in Revelation. And then the challenge for us is, and it's going to be different for every one of us. It may be to do with suffering, it may be to do with compromise, it may be to do with mediocrity, or it may be something completely different. But we're just going to sit here in God's presence and say, God, open my eyes to see my life, to see those issues in a different kind of context. And then let's receive the challenge about realigning ourselves as though God is the center of the universe. Let's see.